is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Friday. It's Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders, ably representing the state of Vermont, and I think, frankly, the entire country, online from us in the Senate recording studio. Senator Sanders, good morning, or good afternoon.
Thank you. Great to be with you, Tom.
Thank you, Senator. Your thoughts on what just happened in the House and what appears to be just about to happen in the Senate?
Well, it's kind of a hectic week because either today or tomorrow, the House and the Senate are going to adjourn and not reconvene until the new session, the beginning of the new year. This has been an interesting week. Earlier in the week, Tom, as you know, the release of the Senate Intelligence Committee's report on torture came out. And I think for many, many Americans, including myself, it was very, very disturbing. While it was not certainly surprising to me, as somebody who had grave misgivings about this war in the first place and the Bush-Cheney administration and what they were doing, it was really disturbing to learn some of the details about the nature of torture that took place. And I think for me, the bottom line is that in a world which is becoming increasingly brutal, I mean, you know, people would be stunned to know what goes on in countries like Syria every single day and how people are being treated in the midst of a war. If the United States of America cannot maintain a moral standard, if we descend into the same type of ugliness that exists around the world, then it becomes impossible for us to be critical and demand changes of other countries. Because they will look at us and say, hey, that's what you guys are doing. Don't tell me we shouldn't torture American prisoners. You do the same thing. Second of all, obviously, it is totally unacceptable that we have a government agency misleading elected officials. Democracy is a nation in which the people, through their elected officials, make the decisions, not agencies of government who do what they want. So that was very, very disturbing, and I hope the end result of that is that the policy of the United States simply and straightforwardly is we do not do torture. In terms of the issue that you raised right now, today, tomorrow, we will be voting on an omnibus appropriations bill, which will be a little bit over $1 trillion. I'm going to vote against that bill for a number of reasons. The truth is that Senator Barbara Mikulski, who is the current chair of the Appropriations Committee, is in a very difficult position because she's negotiating with the Republicans. If you don't reach a decision now, then you're going to have to come back when the Republicans have control over both the Senate and the House, and a bad situation will be even worse. But having said that, I am not convinced that this is by any means the best agreement that could be reached. And there are a number of provisions in this trillion-dollar bill that I strongly object to. One area that has not gotten a lot of attention, not quite sure why, is the fact that 60%, or roughly 60% of this trillion-dollar bill is for the military. And we have got to ask ourselves a very simple question, and that is, at a time when the middle class of this country is disappearing, at a time when our infrastructure is crumbling, at a time when millions of working-class families are unable to send their kids to college, at a time when other students are leaving school deeply in debt, at a time when our child care system is virtually non-existent and not affordable for working families, at a time of enormous unmet needs, should we be spending some 60% of our discretionary spending on defense? Should we be spending almost as much as the entire rest of the world combined? And the answer is, I think not. Do we want a strong defense? Yes, we do. But do we have to spend all that much money, especially understanding? And I hope to get into this issue in greater detail next year. It is no secret that the Department of Defense is unable to even audit their budget. It is so big, so complicated, that they don't have the computer technology to even tell the American people how money is being spent. And second of all, everybody also knows that there's been a whole lot of fraud, committed by large defense contractors, et cetera, et cetera. So I am not sympathetic to spending close to $600 billion on the military. Strong military, yes, but $600 billion, no. Second of all, an issue that has gotten a good deal of attention is that Citigroup put a provision that was put into the House bill and now on the bill that will come to the Senate today or tomorrow, which essentially repeals a provision of Dodd-Frank of protecting taxpayers from bailing out large financial institutions who engage in risky derivative speculation. And it is, you know, we bailed out Wall Street because of their recklessness and illegal behavior. And now what Wall Street is saying, hey, we're back to doing it again, and we want taxpayers to bail us out. If we make a whole lot of money on risky derivatives, we get rich. If we lose a lot of money, taxpayers will bail us out. That may make sense to Citigroup and the other Wall Street financial institutions. It does not make sense to me. It is in the bill. It speaks to the incredible power of Citigroup and Wall Street, and I can't vote for a bill that has that provision. Another provision in there that people have not heard much about is that as a result of language in the bill, there will be some workers who have worked for 20, 30, 40 years, their entire life at a company, who will now end up receiving as much as 50% less than they anticipated in their pensions. You know, what a pension is kind of a sacred contract between a worker. And you say, okay, maybe you didn't get a wage increase this year, but you're here because you know when you retire, you're at least going to get your pension. But now you're seeing all over this country a war against guaranteed pensions, pensions that workers were promised, and we're pulling the rug out underneath them. And that's wrong, and that's in this bill as well. So to my mind, negotiating around here is very difficult. You have right-wing Republicans in control of the House, working for Wall Street, working for the big money interests. But I think we could have done better, and I will vote against this piece of legislation.
I got an email from your office about another piece of legislation that, oh no, it wasn't, it was someplace else, another piece of legislation that just passed that is going to the president. I'm forgetting the details.
Well, there are some, you know, in the midst of a $1 trillion bill, let me be very clear. You know, these votes are never 100% clear cut. There's no bill where there are not good things in it. I'll give you examples of where there are good things. I'm chairman of the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs. And veterans issues are very important to me. The truth is, the budget for the Veterans Administration is a good budget. It is a good budget, and I'm happy about that. And what we managed to get in this bill is what we call advanced appropriations for mandatory funding, which means that if there is ever another shutdown of the government as a result of this legislation, veterans will still continue to get their disability benefits. That's no small thing. That is something that all of the veterans organizations, the American Legion, the DAV, the VFW, the Vietnam Vets, et cetera, have wanted. So it's a good provision. And there are other things. Years ago, when I was in the House, I worked with Barbara Lee on a National Housing Trust Fund bill to focus on low-income housing, which is very, very problematic in many parts of the country. For the first time, we passed that bill a long, long time ago. For the first time, it was funded, I believe there's something like $500 million in it, which will allow us the opportunity to go forward with low-income housing. So in this bill, there are good things, and I don't want to suggest that there are not.
Yeah.
But I think the negative outweighs the positive.
Senator Sanders with us for our hour-long national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. Senator Sanders will be taking your calls right after this. Be sure to check out his website, sanders.senate.gov. You can check out his Facebook page. Just plug in Senator Sanders or Bernie Sanders. And you can tweet to him at Senator Sanders. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And our new book, The American Revolution of 1800, about the election of Jefferson, is out now, just an FYI. And welcome back. Pick up phone calls here, Senator.
Let's do it.
Okay. Kiss Kid. I don't know your real name. It's a kind of a handle, I guess. Watching us on Free Speech TV in Yucca Valley, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders, sir.
Senator Sanders, Tom, my name is Archie. I've talked to you many times.
Great.
You hit on everything, Senator Sanders. There is no place in a spending bill for these this Dodd-Frank Citibank stuff, and you mentioned the pensions. No place for it, short of you filibustering, or because you can stop it, can't you, with a filibuster? But that's two things. Just tell them to strip it out.
Well, you know, I wish, Archie, I wish it worked like that. It didn't. A filibuster could delay it, but unless I am very mistaken, there are a significant, in the Senate, I'm guessing, who knows, 65, 70 votes more to pass it. Right. So I think this thing is likely to pass.
Aaron, in Grandview, Missouri, watching over on Sanders.gov. Hey, Aaron, you're on the air, Senator Sanders.
Hi, I wanted to ask about how you think that you can bring socialist change to America, even though there's a big fear and kind of stigma surrounding not only the concepts, but the very word itself, and how that could be overcome to actually help the people.
Well, thank you, Aaron, for the question. I am a democratic socialist. That's no secret. And you're right in saying that many people don't understand what that word is. And I think probably the best thing to do is to look at those countries, often in Scandinavia, sometimes in Europe, that have adopted programs that work for the middle class and working families of those countries rather than just the very, very wealthy. So if you take a look at a country like Denmark, which over the years has had social democratic governments and sometimes not, what they have ended up establishing are some enormous programs which have worked extremely well. In the United States, for example, we have the highest rate of childhood poverty of any major country on earth. It's somewhere around 20%. One out of five of our kids grows up in poverty. In countries like Denmark, the poverty rate of kids is less than 5%. In the United States, health care, despite the modest gains of the Affordable Care Act, is very, very difficult for people to find a doctor to get quality care at an affordable price. And we have 40 million people who have no health insurance. In countries like Denmark, people just go to the doctor whenever you want to go to the doctor. There is no out-of-pocket expense. That's what governments can do when they work for working families. In this country, as everybody knows, the cost of college is increasingly unaffordable, and many working-class kids are leaving school $40,000, $50,000 in debt. In Denmark, it doesn't cost anything to go to college. That country has decided that making sure that all of their young people, regardless of their income, should get a college education. It's not just Denmark. Germany does the same. Many other countries do the same. So I think we have to talk about what, in fact, already exists in countries around the world that have had social democratic governments.
We'll be back with your calls for Senator Sanders right after this. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to Talk Media for the Sane Among Us. It's the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here on Friday. Senator Sanders with us live from Capitol Hill, from the Capitol building. And Jim in Lockport, Illinois, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, Senator Sanders. How are you?
Good.
My question to you is basically this. With this pending bill that's coming through, do you think we missed a mark by not sending some of these big bank CEOs to prison on their business practices? I mean, I think that would have sent a bigger message, and maybe we wouldn't be attacking Dodd-Frank right now.
I agree with you, Jim. You know, wherever I speak, in Vermont or around the country, and I talk about the Wall Street crash, which had such a horrible impact on millions of people losing their jobs or their homes or their life savings. And when we understand that this was caused by the greed, illegal behavior, the recklessness of Wall Street, and people always ask a simple question. If these guys committed such a horrific crime, which impacted so many millions of people, how come none of them are in jail? And the answer, I suspect, is that our criminal justice system is not meant to punish the most powerful people in the country. That's not what it does. We just, that's not what, where we are. They are too powerful to be punished. There was a line that somebody coined a while ago that not only are these guys too big to fail, the banks are too big to fail, but the CEOs are too big to jail. But I think from the very beginning, and I was very insistent on it, met with the president on this issue, the American people were outraged by the behavior of Wall Street. They wanted to know why this crisis took place, and they wanted the perpetrators, the people who caused this crisis, to be punished. You know, it's amazing. We have more people in jail in America than any other country on earth, and yet the people who committed the most significant crimes that impacted the most people, they didn't see jail time. So I agree with you, Jim.
Roger. Ooh, excuse me, Jeff, in Mount Hope, Wisconsin. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Mr. Sanders. I'm kind of at a loss. I don't feel I have any representation anymore after the vote that went through the House last night. Is our last hope to have Mr. Obama veto this? Because I know he won't, but I mean, is that our last great hope?
Well, unless I'm very mistaken, the president will not veto this. I think he has indicated that he will sign it. He is unhappy about a number of the provisions in it. But from his perspective, I'm talking about, you know, what he says is he thinks the alternative is worse. If we do not have an agreement, the government shuts down. Or if you have a shorter-term agreement, then the Republicans will negotiate something in 3 months. But, Jeff, I think, you know, you're raising a very fundamental issue, and that is given the fact that the Democrats in the Congress are going to be in the minority in both the House and the Senate, what do we do? What is our posture? And what I feel very strongly about, and I've committed, you know, indicated this to the White House, is that the president has got to get up there, above and beyond this legislation, and I'm going to vote against it. And I think he should have vetoed it. But above and beyond this, the president has got to get up there and say, yes, I understand that the Republicans control the House and the Senate, and they won the recent election. I got it. But let me be very clear. If the Republicans bring forth legislation that's going to cut Social Security, I'm going to veto it. If they're going to end Medicare as we know it, I'm vetoing it. If they're going to make cuts in Medicaid, in education, in nutrition, programs that working families desperately need, I'm going to veto it. So save your time. Don't waste time going through this whole business, the legislative process. It ain't going to happen. And those vetoes will be sustained. And then what the president has got to say, okay, there are areas where we can work together. You have some Republicans, for example, who do understand that our infrastructure is crumbling. Now, they don't want to invest as much as I do in rebuilding it, but they're prepared to spend some money. Work with them. Mitt Romney has indicated he supports raising the minimum wage. Well, I would go a lot higher than Mitt Romney, but maybe we can get some progress. Let's find out where we can work together. But what the president has really got to do is get out his veto pen and say, don't waste your time, guys. It ain't going to happen. I'm not going to cut programs that working families need. I'm not going to give tax breaks to billionaires and large corporations. So, you know, save your energy. That's what I think we should be doing.
Robert in Naples, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you for speaking with me, Senator. Senator, mine might be sort of a cynical question, but why does it appear that your positions seem to be on the fringe rather than what I see as America should be clearly in the mainstream? And that being said, do you see a change given Citizens United and the money structure in this country? Do you see a real change towards your positions, or what I see as simply a corrupt and bribed government?
1 minute, Senator.
Okay, Robert, thanks for your question. The truth is, you know, sometimes the media describes me as some kind of far leftist. You know, if I were a far leftist, I would tell you I am a far leftist. I am not. Everything that I talk about, I think, is what a considerable majority of the American people want to see their government do in terms of expanding the middle class, creating jobs, raising wages, dealing with climate change, dealing with women's rights, etc. So I think you're right. Kind of what I talk about is mainstream. What has happened over the years, because of the power of money and the power of Citizens United, the Republican Party has moved from a center-right party to a right-wing extremist party. The Democratic Party has moved from a center-left to kind of a moderate party. And you have millions of working-class families who are not getting the representation that they need. So the one-word answer to your question, Robert, has to do with the huge amounts of money coming into the political process and Citizens United.
It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting here on the Tom Hartman program. Senator Sanders taking your calls. Be sure to check out his website at sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for the Bernie Buzz, his newsletter, which is useful, interesting, informative, occasionally entertaining. All kinds of great news over there at sanders.senate.gov. Check it out.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
You can also find Bernie over on Facebook, and you can tweet him at Senator Sanders. Welcome back. 28 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, this is what happens sometimes when you have a member of Congress on your program and you're doing live television. The Senate apparently called a vote of some kind. Something's going on the floor where Bernie had to run over to the chamber and be present. So Senator Sanders has left the building. Well, he hasn't left the building, actually. He's left our building. He's left our air and headed over to the Senate chamber to do his senator thing. So if you are on hold and you only want to talk to Bernie, you might want to just hang up right now because he's not going to be back as far as we can tell. I mean, if he is coming back, I'll let you know, and then you can call back. But it looks like he had to head over to the Senate. This is, you know, what we're hearing. And Senator Sherrod Brown will be with us at 2 o'clock this afternoon. And, of course, the same thing might happen. Who knows? But we'll see where it goes. So that said, if you're willing to stick on the line, hang out on the line, and we'll start Anything Goes Friday right now, and you're willing to talk to me, I'll pick up your calls. Roger, in how do you say it again?
Snoqualmie.
Thank you.
Snoqualmie.
Snoqualmie.
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Roger.
I've been listening to you all week and have been so happy to hear you using the F word, fascism.
Right.
And I actually have been wanting to talk to you about it for a year because I've read your books and I think we have a common agreement as to the definition. Basically, big government and big corporations ruling for their own self-interest over the rest of us.
Combined with belligerent nationalism.
Yeah, you added that in.
Well, no, actually, the Merriam-Webster added that in.
Yeah, you're right.
1974.
I read a book called Friendly Fascism, written by Bertram Gross. In the 1980, which is kind of really
Are
you familiar with it?
Oh, okay. Roger, I'm going to have to put you on hold. We'll pick up this conversation in a little bit. Senator Sanders is back with us. Senator, you back? He's just putting his headphone in?
Yes.
Okay, Senator Sanders, you're back with us.
I am. I may have to run out. Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa, who has been one of the great senators in recent American history, is on the floor now. He's given his final speech, and people are saying things about him. And Tom has been a real hero in terms of the American Disabilities Act, labor legislation, child labor around the world. And I wanted to say a few words, but apparently they're backed up there a little bit.
Okay.
So let's take some questions, and we'll do that.
Yeah, he's a good man. Pam, in Antioch, Tennessee, you are on the air, Senator Sanders.
Hi. Like my hero, I have a question about corporate taxes, and maybe you can just listen to this idea, see how it sounds. I'm a little tired of hearing the Republicans talk about the job creators and how we can't punish them, and I keep thinking, well, maybe they should put their money where their mouth is, and the corporate tax rate should be in directly proportional to the unemployment rate, like start with a floor value of 25% and then say plus 2 times the unemployment rate and basically say new loopholes. The only loophole you get is to hire American workers. If you want to lower corporate tax rates, you have to hire more people. If the unemployment rate goes up, so do your taxes. We got to put the Americans to work. How does that sound?
Well, I like the general approach. I don't know that I agree with the exact specifics, but let's just talk about corporate taxes. What the corporate line is and the National Chamber of Commerce line is that we overtax corporations, that they're paying the highest tax rates in the entire world. What these guys are talking about is the nominal rate, the rate that is on paper. In reality, the corporate tax rate in America is equivalent. It's about 12% in terms of the effective tax rate of what corporations really pay as opposed to the nominal rate of 35%. What we also know is that major profitable corporations like General Electric, Boeing, Verizon, over a period of recent years, because of all of the loopholes, have paid actually nothing in federal taxes. And the last study that I've seen tells me that one out of four large corporations pay nothing in taxes. So you've got a tax system which is riddled with loopholes, which enables corporations to stash their profits in tax havens like Bermuda or the Cayman Islands, avoiding $100 billion a year in taxes. Now, Pam asks an interesting question, and how do you tie taxation to job creation? Well, interestingly enough, some of the guys who have gotten the largest tax breaks, the corporations in recent years, they're the ones who have laid off more American workers than anyone else. Yeah, they may be growing jobs in China or Vietnam, but not in the United States of America. So I think, yeah, I think you can use a tax policy as a carrot to say to a company, yeah, we're prepared to give you support with taxes, but you have got to start in a significant way growing jobs in the United States of America. And we worked on that concept with a number of federal programs tied to the Export-Import Bank, et cetera, where we said is, yes, we will give support to those companies that are creating jobs in America, but if you are outsourcing your jobs, I can't imagine why in a million years we would want to give you any kind of tax breaks.
Paul in Woodinville, Washington, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, thank you, and it's a pleasure to speak with you, Senator Sanders. My complaint is about prescription drug prices, and let me describe it briefly. As an example, I have an inhaler that I carry in my pocket. Many people do for asthma. It's albuterol. This used to be a generic inhaler. The Medicare Part D prescription drug bill allowed the pharmaceutical companies to rebrand many, many drugs that have been generic for decades. This inhaler that I have in 1982, I used to pay $6 or $8 for this thing. In 2005, even before Med D, I could get it online for $13. As of this year, 2014, this drug before insurance was $54. In 2015, it's $135 before insurance. The problem with the insurance plans is they keep going up and up every year and cover less and less. I'll have to pay 50% of $67 for this inhaler. What this does is to put us in, because of these rising prices, puts those of us who are on Med D in the donut hole earlier in the year, having to pay higher prices. So these drug plans are getting more expensive, they cover less, and they put us in the donut hole earlier, so we're paying more and more for drugs that are not covered. What in the world can be done to stop this highway robbery of the American people? It's not just Democrats, it's Republicans too.
Paul, thanks very much. And you did an excellent job in describing the problem. Ironically, a couple of months ago, we had a hearing just on this issue. And the issue that we focused on is that in the last year or two, we have seen a number of generic drugs, as Paul described, which used to be very reasonably priced, skyrocketing in price. And I mean not a 20% increase, in some cases a 1,000% increase or a 500% increase. And we tried to bring the companies together to tell us why they were doing it, but they didn't show up. And the answer is they are doing it because they can get away with it. So I think the long-term answer to your question, Paul, is that because the United States does not have a national health care program, which is able to negotiate drug prices with the pharmaceutical industry, as is the case in many other countries, where the same drugs we use are sold at a far less expensive price. That is what we've got to do. We've got to say to the drug companies, guess what? You can't raise your prices tomorrow to any level that you want. A lot of people don't have the money to pay for them. There are people who are going to be getting sick. They're going to die. One out of four people in this country does not fill the prescription that their doctors write for them. What kind of sense is that? So you've raised a very important issue, and it's one that we have got to address. And I think the answer is government has got to negotiate prices. These guys can't raise their prices willy-nilly.
Matt in East Jordan, Michigan, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. Thank you, Senator. Several times this president has spoken about wanting to work with this new Republican Congress, and hopefully he's not referring to getting the TPP signed. But my more immediate concern is the chance that this president might try to bring back the horrible grand bargain, that is the assault on Social Security. Do you think the president will possibly bring back the grand bargain to try to work with more reasonable Republicans like Senator McConnell? Thank you, Senator.
Well, Matt, I have been helping to lead the effort here in the Senate to oppose, not only to oppose cuts in Social Security. You know, right now, poverty among seniors is going up. You got millions of seniors who are struggling to put food on their table, to heat their homes, to buy the medicines that they need. And it would be beyond unconscionable to be talking about cutting Social Security benefits. My strong view is we should expand benefits, and we can do that by lifting the cap, which is currently at $117,000 on taxable income. I can't speculate as to what the president will do, but I have personally made it very clear to him on more than one occasion that any effort to cut Social Security, any kind of agreement with the Republicans, is something that I would vigorously oppose.
Okay. And, oh, just 2 seconds. Okay. Thank you, Senator. We'll be back with more calls for Senator Bernie Sanders. On the line with us, it's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting, and we'll be right back.
Listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
15 minutes before the hour, it looks like this time Senator Sanders did have to leave, and so we'll be back with me. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Roger, we in Snoqualmie, Washington, we were talking about fascism.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Yeah, that's Snoqualmie.
Yeah,
I was really pleased this last week to hear you talking about it and giving a good, simple definitions of it. So my question is this just another area where progressives and liberals are pulling their punches? Isn't it time to start referring to the Republican Party as the party of friendly fascism?
I would love to, Roger. Here's the problem with that. When you say fascism to the vast majority of Americans, they immediately think of Hitler. And Hitler was not a fascist.
Right. And
Hitler was a cult leader.
And there were all kinds of fascists in World War II. Not all of them were as anti-Semitic as Hitler was. I think even Mussolini kind of refused to deport the Jews. And Franco was a fascist, and if I recall, I don't think he was internationally belligerent, was he?
I can't say. I don't know that much about the details of World War II. I do know that
you had
three fascist states in Europe: Spain, Italy, and Germany. And Germany was the one that really, I would say, left fascism. I mean, Hitler first brought in all these big corporations, and they all enthusiastically supported his rise to power. They thought he was their guy. And then he largely turned on them, outside of the ones that were involved with the military-industrial complex, as he became basically this maniac who wanted to conquer the world. You know, ein Reich, ein Welt, ein Führer, you know. So that's my worry about using the word fascism. I'll use it here on this program where people are familiar with its meaning and you know, people have heard me explain it. But if a politician of the stature of Senator Sanders were to call the Republicans fascist, it would diminish his credibility. It would hurt him because the media in the United States is by and large not just as misinformed or uninformed as the American public, but close. And they would just ridicule it. You know, they would just say, you know, come on, you're trying to say that Mitch McConnell is like Adolf Hitler. Well, no, that's not what I'm trying to say if I call Mitch McConnell a fascist. I'm trying to say he's more like Mussolini. But even at that, I mean, Mussolini actually dismantled the Italian parliament, replaced it with the Chamber of Fascist Corporations. Mitch McConnell's not proposing that. He's basically what's happened is that our elected officials have become the Chamber of Fascist Corporations. So I think we need a new word, Roger. And, you know, corporatism, Franklin Roosevelt confronted the same issue. His vice president, Henry Wallace, said, yeah, let's call them fascists. And Roosevelt said, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to call them the economic royalists. He came up with a new phrase. So what do you think, Roger?
Well, I think economic royalist is a good term. It doesn't pack the emotional content of friendly fascism. And I think friendly fascism, I think we have to define it for people.
Yeah.
Certainly Mitch McConnell is not like Hitler. Absolutely not. But when you have a system in which the Republican Party is owned by the billionaire class, and specifically the Koch brothers, and the Democratic Party is
rapidly being bought out by Sam. Yeah, I got it. Roger, thank you for the call. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Speaking the truth, multinational corporations would really rather, you know, you didn't know all about. Tom Hartman here with you. Senator Sanders had to head to the floor of the Senate. And so we are senatorless right now. So I will take your calls. And we're just going to start Anything Goes Friday early. Linda in Asheville, North Carolina. Hey, Linda, what's up?
Hey. Hello, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I called last week and I was expressing my disappointment and anger at the betrayal of Barack Obama and signing that budget bill with the things in it that are so abhorrent to the Democratic Party just kind of confirmed what I was calling about last week. This president is willing to throw his base under the bus and has been doing so since he got into the office to make compromises between conservative Democrats and ultra-conservative Republicans and call it bipartisanship. So where do we go when we actually have a president who talks like a populist but acts like a moderate Republican? I have felt that there should be a day when everybody calls in and just calls their representative and say, we're not going to vote for you. We're not going to consciously come out and say, we're not voting for you in 2016 unless you start acting like Democrats again. I mean, he makes people choose between their loyalty to them and really ugly bills. And I feel like he could say, you know what, we're going to go to the CER for 3 months because I want a bill back that's not going to further erode the American middle class and not make us vulnerable again to the Wall Street recklessness. I think everybody would be on board with that.
If President Obama was to start behaving like a progressive populist, I think that he would get a startling amount of support, and far more than his advisors in the White House clearly believe he would get. And the proof of that is what happened with things like minimum wage increases in conservative states in the last election. That said, Linda, we have what we have. You had both President Obama and Jamie Dimon calling Democratic members of the House of Representatives last night, asking them to vote for that bill. And so, I can't put that back in the bottle. Now, my book, The Crash of 2016, the premise of that book is that we did not put together, our financial system was taken apart for the benefit of the billionaires and the banksters by politicians who had been bought by the billionaires and the banksters. And it hasn't been put together back enough that it can be stable, that basically we are still in the crash of 2008, and we're just holding it together with baling wire and bubble gum, and that it's going to disintegrate. It's going to come unraveled. And when it comes unraveled, that is going to present a populist moment for this country, where a genuinely populist politician, someone like Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders or Sherrod Brown, can step up and say, I'm here. You know, I'm going to do something about this. Or a middle-of-the-road politician like Hillary Clinton can become a populist if she wants to reinvent herself to meet the times, very much like Franklin Roosevelt did in 1933. And so, you know, it may be, as much as I hate to say this, it may be a good thing ultimately if we look at it in a 10 or 20-year timescale or a 100-year timescale. It might be a good thing that the Congress just set up the next crash, because there will be a crash when these banksters start gambling with FDIC-insured money. There will be a crash. It's going to take down the markets. And you know, it's like if we can all prepare for that, and both economically and politically, there might be an upside to it.
I hope that you're right, but, you know, I look at the economic conditions that caused Hitler to rise.
Yeah.
We may not get the Sherrod Brown or the, you know.
No, we might get a George W. Bush.
Yeah, and you know, and I appreciate, you know, you always want to look on the bright and on the positive side. But this president has been such a disappointment to me. I worked so hard to get him elected. And again, he seems to just want to compromise and throw his face.
Linda, he is. Let's not be the circular firing squad here. It doesn't. There's no value in it. He's a hell of a lot better than Mitt Romney or John McCain. And tragically, that's about the best we can expect from our current political system because of the actions of the U.S. Supreme Court. And if you want to, you know, point your anger in a particular direction, that would be the place to put it. Because in order to become elected president of the United States, in order to become a United States senator from any state that's got a population of more than a couple million people, you basically got to get in bed with either banksters or billionaires. And that's happening all over the country. And that's the tragedy. That's, you know, the system is badly, badly broken. And like I said, I think that this bill is going to set up. This is, you know, Jamie Dimon has got what he wanted. He's going to make billions. Personally, in all probability, he's going to make billions. And so are the other banksters. And their banks are going to make hundreds of billions of dollars in profit. It's all going to come from us. And they're going to, you know, they're going to suck us dry and kill the country economically. And when they do, you know, we can reboot out of the ashes. And as you said, you know, there's this Hitler danger. And I talk about that in the book. There's a chapter devoted to that. But, you know, net on this, I think the American ideals are strong enough. We've been this kind of a country for long enough that the probability that we go the full fascist route is well less than 50%. But it's still a very real possibility. Linda, thank you for the call. It's a very thoughtful comment. Allison in Sugar Grove, Illinois. We got a minute until the end of the hour, Allison. It's yours.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for your services. I appreciate it. I wanted to talk about, I have a degree in applied mathematics. And I was an adjunct professor and a math tutor at my local community college. And they started replacing the professional tutors with students, actually.
Mm.
And so I wrote a letter to my board and I said, you know, I disagree with this. You know, I have a degree in applied mathematics. All of our tutors in all subjects were always professional, regardless of the subject, math, English, science. And they're replacing us with students. And they were telling me that they didn't have money to pay me. And
right.
That's why I didn't have hours.
Right.
So long story short, I actually got fired over the matter.
Sure.
I wrote a letter to my board members that I elect. And I said, this is what the dean of the department's doing. You know, I think we should stay with professional tutors.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, I hear the music coming.
Yeah. No, I'm, you know, Allison, we're out of time. But your point being that colleges, in an effort to jack up profits or save money, are hurting educational standards, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm with you. And you made the case very well. Thank you, Allison. Well.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Some very interesting stuff here that I want to share with you, and then I'll pick up your calls. We'll do Anything Goes Friday for the next couple hours, although Mimi Kennedy is going to drop by at 20 after this hour, and at the top of the next hour, Senate activity allowing, Senator Sherrod Brown is going to drop by. Gaius Publius, writing over on digbysblog.blogspot.com, has a piece about Burger King's tax inversion and how, you know, it's going to allow Burger King to dodge hundreds of millions, billions of dollars in U.S. taxes. It's really a tax deal. But the thing that I found most fascinating about it, and I don't know why this has not been talked about in the media. I'm guessing probably because so much of our media is now owned by multinational corporations. I mean, even Fox, you know, News Corp is the second largest investor in News Corp, is a Saudi prince behind Rupert Murdoch. So it turns out the Burger King is 69% owned, which means majority owned, by a company called 3G Capital. 3G Capital is a Brazilian company. It's basically one of these private equity firms. It's like a Mitt Romney kind of company down in Brazil. It is there are three partners. One of them is the richest guy in the country, a Brazilian billionaire, and they own more than two thirds of Burger King. Burger King's a Brazilian company, not an American company. And we get all weird about, you know, hey, Burger King's an American company. They're going to do a partnership with a Canadian company. Well, no, it's a Brazilian company. And then, you know, the other weird part about this is this guy who's an Obama bundler. Now, a bundler is a person who raises at least $200,000 at a whack for a candidate by bundling small gifts to comply with McCain-Feingold. And this guy, Antonio Weiss, was a bundler for Obama, but he's also the guy who was worked for the Wall Street bankster firm, Lazard, that helped put together the Burger King deal. Now, it didn't go through, but he's going to get bonuses of between $6 and $30 million if he leaves Lazard and goes to work for the Treasury Department. So it's very, very strange stuff. Jorge Paulo Lehmann is the richest man in Brazil. He's worth $23 billion. So he's worth about a third of what the Koch brothers are. And he and a couple of friends of his are the guys who actually own Burger King. Amazing. Amazing. And then secondly, I just wanted to share with you how much things have changed. Most Americans, particularly Americans under 40, are unaware of this history of the United States. In August of 1969, Richard Nixon was president, and a lawyer for the Associated Milk Producers, this is the milk lobby, walked into the White House and gave Herbert Kalmbach, who is President Nixon's personal lawyer, not his president lawyer, his personal lawyer. So this is anything you give to Nixon's personal lawyer is going right straight to Nixon personally. Right? This is not a campaign contribution. This is a bribe. And the lawyer for the Associated Milk Producers gave Herbert Kalmbach $100,000 to give to Richard Nixon in exchange for him lobbying members of Congress to keep the price of milk high. It's what's called milk support subsidies. As Richard Reeves, a reporter who covered this at the time, told NPR, quote, it was a simple trade. Nixon got $2 million for charging American consumers $100 million. And that was back in the days when $1 million is a lot of money. Then it happened again. I'm going to sneeze here in a second. Excuse me. They always happen in, what, threes, eights, tens? That was two. On May 23rd, 1971, it happened again. Only this time it was $2 million that the, excuse me, that the milk guys gave to Richard Nixon. They walked into the White House with $2 million and gave it to him. It was actually recorded on the White House tapes. It's probably the only time that the bribing of a president has been recorded on tape. But what this illustrates, and keep in mind, this was to get Richard Nixon to call up Republicans in the House and Senate and ask them for a personal favor of supporting milk price subsidies and supports. Keep the price of milk high so that the milk industry could make more money. They'd invest $2 million in a bribe to Richard Nixon, the president. They'd make hundreds of millions. That's how hard it was in 1971 to get the president to work on your behalf if you were a big industry. In this case, the milk lobby, or a lobbyist, or a bankster. Nowadays, they don't have to bribe you. They don't have to. I mean, if you wanted to influence the president of the United States, you want to influence the Democratic Party, you want to influence the Republican Party, all you've got to do is have enough money that you can throw it into enough campaigns that you can get a whole bunch of people to say what you want them to say. Case in point, all the Republicans who are denying climate change because they're taking money from fossil fuel barons. They know what they're doing is wrong. They're not idiots. Jim Inhofe is not an idiot. I mean, he might be in denial, but I frankly doubt it. I think probably back when he wrote his book, he actually believed that there was something to what he was saying. But he can't possibly believe that now. These guys just know which side their bread is buttered on. They know who's paying them. But no longer, you know, the fossil fuel industry, the Koch brothers don't have to go to Jim Inhofe's office and hand $1 million in a briefcase under the table. They do it right out in the open now. And this is all, now keep in mind, these Nixon bribes were in 69 and 71. And these are just one of the few that we know of where Nixon was bribed. He was also bribed in 1959 when he was vice president of the United States by Jimmy Hoffa. I mean, Nixon had been taking bribes his entire political career. But nowadays, you don't need to bribe them. You just drop $400,000 into their campaign. And you don't even have to drop it into their campaign where it has to be revealed to the world. You drop it into you do a blow up 501c3, right? Just create a nonprofit corporation. You don't even have to get the approval of the IRS. You can operate on a provisional basis as if you have approval. And that 501c3 then protects you from having to tell who your donors are. And then you go into the district of that member of Congress or the state of that senator. And you blow out $400,000, $500,000, $600,000, $1 million, $2 million, $10 million, $50 million dollars worth of television advertising. And either elevate that candidate to the point where they get elected or blow away their opponent to the point where that candidate gets elected. And you now own them. So now we have this, I mean, Jamie Dimon calling members of Congress and saying, please vote for this bill. If this was 1971, he would have had to sneak over to the White House and slip Obama a couple million bucks in a briefcase. And frankly, I don't think Obama would have taken the money. But now our system has been so badly corrupted by these monarchs. In our constitutional monarchy, the five of the nine members of the U.S. Supreme Court, the conservative gang of five, our system, our democratic republic, has been so corrupted by big money that our politicians are no longer trustworthy. And they're not trustworthy because they have to depend on these guys if they want to be elected. They have to. This is just our system. So rather than sitting around going, oh, you know, this is terrible that Obama was calling or Jamie Dimon was able to, we should say, this should be a crime. We're going to go back to the laws that said that you cannot give money to members of Congress in exchange for their doing favors for you. It's called bribery. 15 minutes past the hour. Pick up your calls right now.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Anything goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. You can also drop by our live chat room and say hi. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Whoops. I just minimized a page. I'll fix it during the break. Let's pick up some phone calls here. Clifford in Ishpeming, Michigan, watching Free Speech TV on Dish. Hey, Clifford, what's on your mind?
I sure hope you have a lot of people watching today, and I hope enough of them are disgusted enough that they will start doing something. I would like to know, I don't care whether it's, I spent 3.5 hours in Bibby Stabenow's office. I spent time on the local Democratic Party with the press. I try to do what I can, but,
yeah.
You know, what I would like to ask the question, what has, you know, making the banks not liable for anymore do with the spending bill? What does some of these others? And the answer is, and we've got to do this, even if it means the public voting on it. This is important stuff. You've got to have, I know I sound like a broken door, window, but you've got to have clean bills. If you're going to have a spending bill, it's what do we spend money on.
Right.
And if we don't, as voters, if we don't start insisting that if our, you know, I listen to, well, we have to vote for it, don't want to, but this, that's crap. That is absolute crap. Make it, hey, the Republicans did it, so let's do it.
Yeah.
Shut the government down.
Well, oddly enough, Clifford, this is one of the things that Newt Gingrich was swept to victory on in 94? Whenever the Gingrich Revolution was I don't know if this was part of his contract on America or this was a separate issue, but I remember Gingrich talking about this a lot back in the 90s, that he was sick and tired of you know, omnibus bills coming through and governing by continuing resolution and that kind of thing, and that legislation should, every piece of everything that you want the government to do should be done in a separate bill. So, you know, if you want to have a bill that does something to or for or against even the EPA, make it a separate bill so you can have debate on that particular issue. If you want to do something about, you know, tax rates or tariffs or whatever it may be, make it a separate bill. Because what's happened is that with this omnibus nonsense, it gives cover to the people who are, again, taking money from the lobbyists, which is, you know, solidly half and probably 3/4 of all the members of Congress are taking big money from lobbyists. They have no choice, most of them. And so it allows them to say, well, you know, I'm opposed to this, but I really have no choice. I've just, you know, it's because it's like, you know, if we don't pass this bill, it's going to shut down the government. And there's some good stuff in here that we've got to have, you know, that kind of thing. And it provides cover to them. And, you know, it shouldn't be that way. I'm absolutely with you that, you know, legislation should be specific. It should be challengeable. It should be debated. But, again, as long as we have this broken system, this gets us back to movetoamend.org. We have to amend the Constitution to say the Supreme Court was wrong in 1976 in Buckley when they said that money is speech. And they were wrong in 2010 in Citizens United when they reaffirmed that corporations are people and therefore have 14th Amendment rights and First Amendment rights of free speech. We have to say no. And Clifford, thank you for the call. This is just, it's like enough already. We have to fix our system. We have a badly broken system. We are in a moment that's not unlike the moment right after 1900, where senators were being appointed by the states, and it was insanely corrupt, where state legislatures were not listening to their people. And the result of that was the Tillman Act in 1907, the direct election of the Senate, a whole lot of good progressive change. 9 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Mimi Kennedy is on the line with us, actress, activist, writer, board chair of Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org, and star of the hit series Mom on CBS. And she also works with free-don.org, who you hear about literally every day on this program. Mimi, welcome.
I'm so glad to be here, Tom.
Thanks for joining us.
It's all working on the Skype, is it?
Oh, yeah, it's working great. And you look great, and you sound great. It's spectacular. So big happenings going on with Don Siegelman. I've referred to this the last couple of days, but not in great detail. Tell us what's going on.
Okay, well, Don Siegelman, who, I mean, I think all your listeners know, you say the Free Don website every day. And ex-governor of Alabama, most popular Democrat in Alabama, up and coming onto the national stage. He was disappeared, really, by the forces of the right-wing GOP in the 2000s during the Bush administration. And he ended up, you were talking about bribery earlier and obvious quid pro quos. Judge Mark Fuller, who handled the prosecution, took the case that was prosecuted by some Republican attorney, U.S. attorneys, said that the jury could find inferred bribery. That means even though there was no actual proof in evidence, you could suspect a bribe had gone on and therefore convict Don Siegelman 7 years in prison.
Wow.
He's been trying to appeal his case. The Department of Justice has never done anything about that appeal. They didn't pardon him. Obama wouldn't pardon him. This is the crime that dare not speak his name. So Don Siegelman went to Oakdale Prison in Louisiana, and with Americans rising up in the streets about how people have been targeted entirely by race and incarcerated, mass incarceration, Don Siegelman, a powerful white guy, has gone to prison because he was targeted for his political opinions, I think, and the fact that he was in the Democratic Party in the South. So he's spent 2 years there. And the inmates sent him off with a homemade meal, a prison homemade meal, and fond goodbyes, saying, we hope we never see you again here, only as a free man. A new judge is taking Don's cases, Judge Land, because Judge Mark Fuller, who oversaw the prosecution and the sentencing of 7 years previously on the Alabama Federal 11th Circuit, he's doing a little time of his own in rehab for spousal abuse. His wife made a 911 call in, I believe, August, The judge was hitting his wife on the 911 call. So he's been relieved of his cases. And suddenly, Don's hearing for release pending appeal and appeal for a new trial are both being heard. Monday, December 15th, he walks into court. And at 10:30 a.m. Eastern, we're going to do a social media thunderclap, which means everybody who lets their Twitter, Facebook accounts be used for this will receive a candle flame of hope and free Don as the message. And that will spread his story and let him know that he has support all over the nation for this aspect of a restoration of justice. And we know when he gets out, he will be a very strong voice for restoration of justice, voting rights, an end to mass incarceration, an end to being targeted for your race on the street and killed with impunity. That's all down the road. But right now, there's a great deal of hope among the people who know Don Siegelman's story that there might be a restitution of justice and a revelation of voting fraud. I mean, not voting fraud, election fraud. The voters are doing fine. Election fraud, when Don's reelection as governor was stolen by a shift of 3,000 votes in the night. I don't know we'll ever go into that, but that's how this started. Right. And we will end political targeting of dissenters or even popular Democrats who speak out on behalf of the oppressed.
So people can go to free-don.org and click the link to get to the Thunderclap site. I did that earlier, and I saw the Thunderclap site and all that, but it wasn't clear to me exactly what I should do. I didn't see a button that said click here to do this. What did I miss?
On the Thunderclap site?
Yeah.
Well, they have a lot of information, and then you go down below, and it says sign up your Facebook, sign up with your Twitter account.
Oh, so that's how you have to do it, or support with Tumblr. Those are the three action things.
Those are the three options they give you there.
Ah, okay. All right. We will support with both Facebook and Twitter. So that's how you do it. Thank you for that, Mimi. I've been trying to and scratching my head.
I was looking
for a PayPal link or something too, I didn't see that. So Don is on. He's actually on his way to the courthouse right now as we speak, right?
Yeah, it took 10 days, and they went via a very roundabout route. No one knows why. People are being very close-mouthed about it because ongoing investigation. Nobody wants to mar this hope. But he's cuffed and shackled, and he is in the custody of federal marshals. I don't know how he'll walk into the courtroom, but it's been a roundabout route, and he will be in Montgomery, Alabama on Monday morning. And I don't know where he is up until then, and I'm not sure how many people do, and that's kind of fine with me as long as people know it's happening and there is a lot of attention to the fact that this journey is occurring.
Yeah, and I'm on the email list also, and everybody can get on it just by going over to free-don.org. And his little letters from prison and whatnot, very, very touching, very thought-provoking.
Yes. Tom, I want to thank you just for all the attention that you've given to this case. It really passed under the radar of most Americans during the Bush administration. It went on for many years, the appeals. But because so much of this case involved a kind of a hornet's nest of things people don't want to talk about.
Especially Karl Rove.
Yeah.
Especially Karl Rove. That's the amazing thing. Mimi, and I'll tell you that story to my listeners and viewers. I'll tell you that story sometime, again, one of these days. PDAmerica.org, free-don.org, Mimi Kennedy. Thank you, Mimi.
Thank you, Tom.
It's
Thank you, listeners.
Great talking with you. We will be back. It's 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Free-don.org. Check it out. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Front page of Huffington Post, calling it what it is. The headline, oh no, triangulation is back. Subheads, revolt against the president over Wall Street. Giveaway, jackpot, bankers cash in. Bill matches Citigroup proposal nearly word for word. Jamie Dimon personally lobbied members of Congress. Liberals furious. Bonanza, banks score exemption from transparency bill. I mean, this is ugly. This is really ugly. Andrew in Green River, Wyoming. Hey, Andrew, what's up? Andrew, you are on the air. You got to listen to your phone, not your radio. Pat in, you can call back, Andrew. Pat in Chalmont, New York. Hey, Pat.
Yeah, Tom. I was listening to you talk about the money that Nixon took and all that, and the one thing I did hear later on that you did say that, 70% of the politicians in Washington are probably taking bribes, but I was looking at campaign contributions of the major corporations in America, companies that are in the above the $10 million donation level. And it is a rule, I'd say it's more like 90% of the politicians, regardless of the party, are taking money because depending upon the company, they'll give 45% to one party and 55% to the other party. But, nobody's hands are clean in this. And even as far as
By and large, Pat, if you go through the list of the members of the Progressive Caucus, and there's about 100 members, there are 535 members of Congress. There's 435 members of the House of Representatives, 100 senators. That's 535 altogether. You got about 100 of them in the Progressive Caucus. So that's a little less than one out of five, or what, 20%. So that the other 80%, I would say, are firmly in the pocket of somebody, and the people in the Progressive Caucus, by and large, aren't. That's why they can be in the Progressive Caucus. And the only reason that they're not is because they come from a small enough district or a solid blue enough district that the situation with Bernie. Bernie can get it. When Bernie ran for Senate, they spent $5 million. He refused to run a single television ad. And they spent $5 million in advertising just in Vermont. And this was, 8 years ago when $5 million was a lot of money. And they were unable to knock him out, even though they called him god-awful things. They were unable to knock him out because he'd been a politician in Vermont for 30 years. And he'd probably shaken the hand of everybody in the state at least three times. Everybody knew him. They came in. He had voted against a bill back when he was in the House of Representatives like 20 years ago that was theoretically a bill to stop child pornography, but in fact was just an absolute assault on the internet, on the ability of Americans to have any privacy. And so Bernie voted against it because he thought it violated the Fourth Amendment. Well, they ran television ads saying that Bernie Sanders was in favor of child porn. And people in Vermont just said, come on, we know Bernie. So you can do that in a small state. And you can do that in a small district, and you can do that if you're well-known. So Keith Ellison can do that, Raul Grijalva can do that, and Jan Schakowsky can do that, and Senator Bernie Sanders can do that. They can be themselves, they can stand up, and they can say, I'm not taking money from Citigroup. But on the other hand, if you're running for the United States Senate from a really large state, and it'll be interesting to talk to Sherrod Brown when he comes on about this, because he's from Ohio, which is a fairly large state. Although, you know, arguably he did get special interest money. I'm pretty sure he got money from unions. But you know, I'm fine with that. But do you get my point, Pat? I don't think it's 90%. I think it's 80%.
To me, it's you know, they're all equally guilty, and the paybacks are, you know, to me a little more obvious, where you have the environmental people backing the president, and all of a sudden all these green energy outfits are getting hundreds of millions of dollars of taxpayer money and rolling up, going broke, and moving their operations overseas. I'm not saying that I'm arguing against you. I'm just saying, to me, it's not an R and D issue anymore. It's a P issue. The politicians are crooked, and it just it
upsets me. Well, you know, Pat, hold on for just a second. If the NFL put a new rule in, and I think I used this metaphor yesterday. Remind me if I did, Shane. I might have used it on television last night. If the NFL put a new rule in that said that any team could choose to have the side of the field that they're running toward, in other words, the side that they've got to score, you know, a touchdown on, to have that side of the field be 40 yards long instead of 50 yards long, they could just choose to do that, right? Move the goalposts in 10 yards. This is the new rule. You can choose to do that if you want. Now, there are some teams who might look at that and say, you know, that's wrong. That's not how we play football. But I think most teams eventually would get to the point where they're saying, you know, we're going to take that 10-yard rule, and we're going to move the goalposts in 10 yards as we're moving down the field. And so when you change the rules of the game, the players will accommodate that. They have to. It doesn't mean that they're corrupt. It doesn't mean that they're evil. It doesn't mean that they're even despicable or disgusting. It simply means that the rules of the game have changed, and so the players are adapting their strategies to that. And this is what happened in 1976 in the Buckley versus Vallejo case before the United States Supreme Court, where the argument was that you had a politician who wanted to use his own money. He was a very rich guy. He wanted to use his own money to fund his own campaign. And he said, I should be able to spend my own money on my own campaign, because I have freedom of speech under the First Amendment. And the Supreme Court agreed with him on that in Buckley versus Vallejo. That was 76. In 77, you had a corporation in Boston. There was a law against corporations in Boston giving money to politicians or to campaigns unless it had something specifically to do with an issue that corporation dealt with. And then they had to do so transparently. First National Bank of Boston was supporting an anti-abortion campaign, which has nothing to do with banking. And Frank Bellotti, the attorney general of Massachusetts, sued them and said, what, you've committed a felony. This is a crime against the laws of the state of Massachusetts. It went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, well, last year we said that spending money on politics is free speech if it's a billionaire who's running for Congress, or a millionaire running for Congress in this case. This year we're going to say that corporations have that same free speech right, and they have the ability. So those two decisions in 76 and 77 set all of this up. And then in 2010, the Supreme Court put it on steroids with Citizens United, where they brought these two things together, that corporations have rights under the 14th Amendment as persons, that spending money to buy politicians is no longer do you have to sneak into the White House with a briefcase and slip it to Richard Nixon. You can simply do it out in the open because you have a First Amendment protected right. These are changes to the rules of the game, Pat. And so, you know, if we're outraged about it, and I suspect you and I both are, then we should be working to change the game, not accuse the players of corruption. Am I making sense?
Oh, no, you are. But my point was, and you kind of reinforce it, saying that, you know, because the rules change, the guys that are playing the game are taking advantage of it. It just, you know,
Pretty much they have to if they're from big states.
Yeah, and it kind of, you know, irks me a bit where, you know, because I'm an independent guy where, you know, the two big sides stand and point fingers at each other when they're both guilty of the same thing, just at different events.
Well, they're guilty of it, but see, here's the thing. Before 1976, they would have both been guilty of crimes, of federal felonies, of go to prison things. Today, what the Supreme Court has said is that what these guys are doing is perfectly legal. They have changed the rules. It's now legal to say, okay, we're heading down the field. It's second down and four to go, and we're down to the 12-yard line, and we're going to move that goalpost up to the 10-yard line. So we only have to go 2 yards for a touchdown. I mean, that's what. Go ahead.
Well, I guess I appreciate you giving me time to you know, voice my opinion and
okay.
Spending so much time with me, but I don't want to take up any more.
Okay, Pat, thank you very much for the call. I think that's a really important point, though, that we have to separate politics from politicians, and we have to separate the rules of the game from the game itself and the people playing it. We have to have a sophisticated understanding of what's going on here. Bumper sticker understandings of it, you know, evil politicians, term limits, stuff like that. They are, and term limits is the most often recommended solution. Gee, we got a bunch of corrupt politicians. Let's term limit them. All that does is add to the power of the banksters and of the lobbyists because they become the permanent infrastructure for the legislature. Rich in Calumet, Michigan. Hey, Rich, what's on your mind today? Rich? Rich is not listening to his phone. Robert in Houston, Texas. Hey, Rich. Hey, Robert, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I was listening to the show the other day, and you said something about that the oil prices tumbling might participate the crash.
Yeah.
That's coming. I would like to see if you would speak more about that and how that would all look.
Yeah, I would be glad to. There's a very interesting blog about this. It's called The Economic Collapse blog.com. And it's, you know, there's some kind of crazy right wing stuff there and, you know, buy gold and buy emergency food and all this kind of stuff. And I'm not endorsing the site, but the guy who I believe owns and writes for the site has posted a couple of blogs about how three out of four times in my lifetime, when the price of oil has substantially collapsed, that has led to a collapse of the bonds that are issued by small oil drilling companies, and there's hundreds of them in the United States. And those bonds are traded on the junk bond market. And when the junk bonds start collapsing, because those companies start going out of business, it costs anywhere from $45 to $80 a barrel to frack oil out of the ground. And so when the price of oil is over $100 a barrel, these companies are profitable. When the price goes down to $65 a barrel, about half of them are put out of business. When they go out of business, their bonds collapse. When the junk bond market collapses, the stock market follows suit within 6 months, historically. And that's the point he's making, and that's the point that I was making. So, you know, I hope you can track that down. It's theeconomiccollapseblog.com. Robert, thanks for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Oh, this is interesting. Michelle Bachmann's being interviewed by Wolf Blitzer because she's leaving Congress. What do you want to bet they don't mention the fact that she's leaving because she was facing federal indictment? Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. This is interesting. Shane just pointed out to me that after Citizens United, Russ Feingold continued to say, I'm not going to take money from, you know, big money from anybody, including unions. And, you know, including big guys on the left, I'm going to operate by the old rules. So Russ Feingold essentially said, I'm going to leave the goalpost where it is. The other team can move their goalpost in 10 yards when they're running towards it, but I'm going to leave it where it is. I'm going to play by the old rules. And guess what happened? Russ Feingold lost. And he's not a crook, but he lost. Yeah, right, Shano. So anyhow, John in Minneapolis watching Free Speech TV. Hey, John, what's up? John, can you hear me? I think, it could be. I don't know. Gary in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Gary, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Great. Okay, I'm starting to worry here. What's on your mind?
How are you, Dr. Hartman?
I am well, thank you. I hope you are well, Gary.
Thank you, sir. First thing I wanted to I don't know if, you know, I worked in the financial services industry. Actually, I worked in the S&L industry for, I think, 20 years until Cheney blew it up. And then I went to work for large commercial banks, Wells Fargo, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the and I worked with the investments people. One of the things I learned, which, you know, it should be obvious, but I figured it out. And if this little, can I say turd on your?
I think you just did, but let's use a different word if we can.
If this little nugget about insuring Wall Street casino gambling passes, that money, the institutions just simply take that increase that they're charged by the Fed and pass it right back through to the customer.
Well, not only that, what's going to happen, Gary, is that once those securities are basically FDIC insured, the value of those securities is going to go up dramatically. So if Citigroup is sitting on $200 trillion worth of derivatives right now, without creating one new derivative, they might be sitting on $300 trillion worth of derivatives in January when this bill goes into effect. Tell me if I'm wrong on that. I mean, isn't the value of a derivative based in part on the risk associated with it?
Absolutely. And I remember seeing not Greenspan, but I think it was Greenspan during the crash talking about how he had a room full of MBAs, I think it was. And the our PhDs,
mm-hmm.
room full of PhDs could not figure out how these derivatives in Congress work.
Right.
In Congress and big banks work.
Right.
And he's a PhD himself, I think.
Right. Yeah. Dr. Alan Greenspan. Yeah, absolutely. And that's where was it Nancy Pelosi, I think, on the floor of the House was saying this is a moral hazard. And what she was talking about is we're creating a situation where the banksters, heads I win, tails you lose, they're playing a game that is rigged. And it's the moving the goalposts metaphor again. Only this time, you know, they'd be crazy not to go with the moved goalposts, and they will instantly do that. And Gary, thank you for the call. I predict, you know, Jamie Dimon has a big bonus coming. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, fair and only slightly unbalanced. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service for the news of the day, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where you can find one of my wife's favorite pieces of jewelry, a glass crystal heart that's handmade by women in South Sudan who saw a family member murdered in front of them. This is a PTSD curing program that Ellen Ratner created on one of her trips, and one of the trips that I went with her on to South Sudan. It's just quite extraordinary. Ellen, welcome.
We need you on another trip, Tom. Okay. Well, as you know, there is a Senate vote on the shutdown. Harry Reid said that the bill achieves important priorities about Affordable Health Care Act, getting financial footing. He said, listen, they wanted no financial limits on campaign contributions. This was a compromise. The bill is a compromise. Then you have our hero, Senator Bernie Sanders, saying that he is not going to vote for this. And he said why, and he basically gives a progressive reason. He says instead of helping to strengthen Social Security, Medicare, and other programs, this bill allows the Pentagon to spend almost as much as the rest of the world combined on our military and never-ending wars in the Middle East instead of rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure and creating millions of decent jobs. It lets company renege on promises they made to their workers by cutting pension benefits instead of cracking down on Wall Street CEOs, that it allows another taxpayer bailout, basically, of these corporations. And so there he is. I mean, he has really done the work of what most of us are thinking.
Yeah.
Now, what's really fascinating is there is a group called Ready for Hillary, and actually a friend of mine started it. But now there is a readyforwarren.com, and what it says, and a group of people people today, and actually I've printed out the list. It's about 300 former Obama staffers. And we're not talking about lightweight staffers. We're talking about people who ran his computer operation, who ran his field operation in different states, et cetera. And they said that they now want Elizabeth Warren to run. They said they believed in an unlikely candidate who no one thought had a chance. We worked for him, and against all odds, we won in Iowa. We organized like no campaign organized before. Now, former staffers from President Obama's campaigns, along with former staffers from other Democratic groups, OFA, are joining with thousands of Americans and calling on Elizabeth Warren to run for president in 2016.
Wow.
It's quite shocking. I mean, the whole thing is on readyforwarren.com.
Huh. Okay, great. Thank you for that.
Pretty amazing. Also, today, Steny Hoyer issued, he's a minority whip, he reminds people to enroll in health care by the deadline, which is this coming Monday, December 15th.
Whoa.
This is the open enrollment period. Yeah, I know. I have to enroll myself, actually.
Yeah.
They said that an estimated 70% of current enrollees can find more affordable plan by returning to the marketplace to shop again this year.
Okay.
So that's kind of interesting. Also, now this is pretty amazing. The group, the CARE group, which is a CAIR, which is a Muslim group, has now gotten support from Orthodox Jewish groups. They are filing with the Supreme Court a friend of the court brief, and they are in favor of a Muslim's women's right to wear a headscarf at work. The brief was filed by a company, a Nathan Lewin of Lewin and Lewin in Washington, and they're going to expect, the Supreme Court hasn't announced a date, but probably in February or March, or whether an applicant's failure to give explicit notice that she is practicing Muslim who wears a headscarf at work. You know, a lot of these people won't wear one for an interview, but then they do wear one at work, and the question is whether a company has a right to say that they don't meet the requirements. You know, Disney has very strict dress requirements.
Yeah.
I don't allow my employees to wear jeans.
Really, you don't?
Oh, I do not. I'm a beast.
I could not work for you. I haven't worn anything except jeans in decades.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
My gosh. I am the worst of the worst.
I guess.
also, now this is, again, not particularly news, but it is interesting that the coroner in Cleveland declared Tamir Rice's death a homicide. Reuters reported this today. And what they're saying is that the autopsy released today that he was found struck once in the abdomen, and it said that he sustained a single wound on the left side of his abdomen that traveled from the front to the back and lodged in his pelvis and was enough to kill him.
Wow. But this is the 12-year-old kid who was playing with a toy gun in the
And
in
was
the
shot within something like 2 seconds or something,
right,
when they got to the area.
Right. The police car pulls up. The guys jump out. Bang, bang. He's dead.
And then
they handcuffed his, he was 12. They handcuffed his 14-year-old sister, who was hysterical, and threatened his mother.
I mean, it's really, and his parents are being very, very active in this.
Yeah. Well, that's good, because this is a bad case. This was, and in fact, the officer who shot him had been fired or let go or something, pushed out of a previous police department, and his write-up had said that this is a guy who should not have a gun.
That's absolutely correct. Interesting,
so,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, and they never looked at the former police department records on him.
I know. It's this is why we need higher standards for policing and better pay for police in this country.
You know, it's interesting. I once lost a purse in Norway, and I left it on a bus. And I came back 45 minutes later, and it was on the bus. And so I said to them, you know, why does this happen? Well, we have very high standards here. Do you know that to be an officer in a jail, you have got to have the equivalent of at least a 2-year post high school degree,
right,
in order to even become just a low-level officer in a jail.
Right, and to be a cop, you have to have a 4-year degree.
Yeah, I mean, they are very, very strict. A life sentence is 21 years in the Netherlands and in Norway.
Yep. We could learn a lot from them.
So, just one other quick thing on what's going on in the Senate. As you know, there is a group that is opposed. I don't know if they're going to get the count. The president did sign a bill today extending the government for 2 days.
Just in case.
Just in case.
Okay, so we'll see. We'll see if somebody tries to filibuster this thing, whether it's Ted Cruz or Elizabeth Warren. Very interesting. Ellen Ratner, thank you. Goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Ellen. Yeah, there she goes. Without jeans.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends. Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, you'll just look at some of the headlines in the news. Welcome back to the program, by the way. Tom Hartman here with you, helping you win the water cooler wars. Creed's, this is over at TPM, Creed's Scott Stamp threatened to kill Obama. Yes, really? And then Cruz unearthed 1795 time capsule buried by Paul Revere and Sam Adams. That's got to be fascinating. They pulled this thing out yesterday. So we don't know what's in it yet. Apparently some coins. Maybe they've x-rayed it. I don't know. Ginsburg reportedly canceled her New Republic subscription. Geraldo has a new slogan for black protesters. You're supposed to go out in the streets and shout, "We're the problem." Yeah, great, Geraldo. This is it's amazing. The House Intel chairman. I forget his name. Yeah. Anyhow, I recognize his face. Yeah, Rogers. I think it's Mike Rogers. Yeah. Benghazi report critics didn't read the report. Right. So, anyway, a lot of interesting stuff going on. We are hoping that any moment shortly, Senator Sherrod Brown will drop in. Is that him on the phone or not? No? Okay. In that case, I'm going to pick up Max in Glendale, Arizona. Hey, Max. Thanks for listening. What's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. The request that I'm about to make, I need to make through you. I was hoping to make it directly to Senator Sanders. As useful as the discussions are when things like this bill come up and at a crossroads, I'm really excessively irritated that the strongest and most outspoken people representing us won't take tangible action.
Well, what? I'm sorry, you broke up, Max. Won't take tangible action. Okay, Max, your phone has just disintegrated. I don't know if it's our phone lines or yours, but it sounds like a cell phone that croaked. You know, I think your point was that, you know, what is the old saying? The only thing necessary for evil to triumph is for good people to do nothing, for good men to do nothing. I think it was the original version of it. It's one of those German philosophers or something. But, you know, Elizabeth Warren is speaking out. Senator Sanders is voting no on it. We'll see. We'll see. We'll see where it goes. But as I've been saying all day and as I've been saying for years, I wrote a book about this called Unequal Protection. We have a structural problem. We don't have a problem with individual politicians. I mean, there are some that are pretty weird. But we have a problem with the rules of the game of politics. And once they corrupted, and the Supreme Court did this, once they corrupted the rules of the game of politics, that in turn corrupted the rules of the game of business. And so now we have, you know, politics and business contaminating each other, and it's just a really, really, really bad combination. Mary in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. Hey, Mary, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I listen to you almost every day.
Thank you.
And I think you're probably the best talk show host on the radio. And I wouldn't probably do my day without listening to you because it's a very depressing world. However, when I listen to you, I argue with you all the whole 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
I find myself arguing with you. And today you've talked about a lot of subjects, and you really got me livid.
Okay, go for it. Let's argue.
Okay.
What are you upset about, Mary?
First of all, let me preface with my comment with saying I live in Williamsport, which is Foxport, USA. And my best friend follows Fox and all of Glenn Beck and Limbaugh and all that all day long. And he has become an authoritarian follower, as John Dean observed in his book, Conservatives Without Conscience.
Right.
And what you were just talking about is how the rules change and how that creates behavioral changes in individuals. I have a bit of a problem with that. You call it moral hazard.
No, Nancy Pelosi called it moral hazard. I was quoting her.
Okay, all right. All right, okay. And isn't it an individual issue when it finally comes right down to it? I spent years studying the Nazis. And, you know, they didn't even have television.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, they had radio, though, and they used it very effectively.
Yeah, they had radio. Yeah, and they had video.
Yeah.
And if you ever
watch Leni Riefenstahl's movie, which was required to be played in every theater in Germany before every movie for 6 years, get it that they were very good at propaganda.
Yeah, but they don't.
Power of the will, I think it was called. Yeah.
They don't have the same level of mass-mediated culture that we have.
Right. So what's your point, Mary?
Okay, my point is that when we forgive people or we say, "Oh, it's just the rules," which is what you could say about Germany. Okay.
I am not saying it's just the rules. What I am saying though is that if we aim too low, we're only going to take out the feet. Right. To use a very military metaphor, the fact of the matter is that when the Supreme Court changed the rules of the game with Citizens United in 2010, what was his name, Shane? We were talking about just a second ago, the senator from Wisconsin, Russ Feingold. Russ Feingold was up for re-election, and he said, you know, even though Citizens United allows me to go to big unions or allows me to go to wealthy progressives around the country and raise an enormous amount of money to win my campaign, I'm going to operate by the old rules. I'm going to operate with what I consider to be integrity. And guess what? He lost.
Yes, he lost because the fungible minions of America have not been educated by anybody but Fox News.
Yeah, since the 1980s. I don't disagree.
Yeah. Yeah. So how can we be positive? How do we stay positive when the minority voices are not being heard? Sometimes I feel like their voices, we're all just voices crying in the wilderness.
Yeah.
And that, you know, we need to use the word fascism, but we need to teach the American people what it means.
Yeah, I agree with you, Mary. If I may, recalibrate or adjust one of your statements. You said the minority voices, as if your voice and my voice are minority voices. The fact of the matter is, when you ask the American public, do you think Medicare and Social Security should be strengthened or should be reduced? More than 70% of Americans will say strengthen Medicare. More than 80% of Americans will say strengthen Social Security. When you ask the American citizens, do you think that we should have a national health care system that covers everybody for free, like Canada's does, you know, or for a small fee? I think in Canada it's $140 a month you have to pay for health insurance. Over 65% of Americans say yes. If you ask Americans, do you think that it should be easier to vote? Do you think that people should be able to register to vote on the same day that they vote and it should be easier to vote? The vast majority of Americans say yes. If you ask Americans, do you think that the EPA should be protecting our air and our water? Are you concerned that the USDA and the FDA are allowing things like bisphenol A into our food supply, and our food supply should be more tightly regulated? We need to get more pesticides out of it. The vast majority of Americans say yes. Pick a progressive position. Almost any progressive position, and you will find that more than 50% of Americans agree with you. So it's not a minority voice that is not being heard. It's the majority voice that's not being heard. And that's a testimonial to the power of money under these new rules.
It's money in the media. So how do we counteract that?
Well, the number one, you take money out of politics so that your politicians can start changing the rules. And I know both Democrats and Republicans who are both equally horrified by the fact that they have to spend half of every day fundraising. So this is actually something Republicans would go for, too. Once you've gotten money out of politics so they're no longer beholden to moneyed interests, then you start passing rules like, okay, we're going to start enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, which Reagan stopped in 1982. We're going to break up some of these big companies. When AT&T got broken up, it was good for shareholders. Mary, I could go through a whole long list. I wrote a book about it called Rebooting the American Dream.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Not to just gratuitously plug my own book, but I really, there's 11 steps in there, and you know, this is just one of them, and I think that we need to do these things. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Dan in Tell City, Indiana. Hey, Dan, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. What's up?
I was just listening to all that going on yesterday about the Cromnibus bill, and it just really upset me. It's definitely you're going to be right on with your book, The Crash of 2016, because it's definitely going to crash now. It's just history repeating itself, it's the third time, and you know. But I don't know where it's going to crash. Last time it was the mortgages. This time possibly the bond market, the way
They're creating derivatives out of rental properties. They're creating derivatives out of student loans. They're creating derivatives out of auto debt. So, you know, and they're still doing it with mortgages, although the mortgage market has cleaned up a little bit. But now they're starting to do subprime mortgages again. So I'm very concerned. The black market for commodities, the invisible market for commodities, is estimated to be between $300 and $700 trillion. The GDP of the entire United States is only $15 or $16 trillion. So this is, if that something that large goes down, it takes countries with it. And
well,
go ahead, Dan.
It's also, you know, it's going to hit the lost my train of thought there. But I'm just wondering what people are going to be affected by it.
The people who are hurt the worst when a market crashes like it did in 2008, the people who are hurt the worst are the people in between. The people who have everything paid off and have a little bit of money in the bank, they don't have to be rich, but, you know, they have everything paid off, they're debt-free. Those people are generally not hurt the worst. And the people who are up to their eyeballs in debt, who are just totally maxed out in debt, they're typically not hurt the worst by a crash like this because they can walk away from that debt, or everybody's got debt. They could just, you know, muddle on through. But it's the people who have, you know, half the equity in their house paid off, right? They have their house half paid off, and then the value of the house collapses, and now they're stuck. You know, they really can't walk away from it because that's their life savings. So, you know, I talk about this in the crash of 2016 that, you know, I'm not offering financial advice to anybody, but what I am saying is that when a country hits a major stock market crash like we had in 1929, like we had in 2008, and like I believe we're going to have next year or the year after, that when a country hits one of those things, the people who are the best off, who do the best, are the people who have paid off all their debt or the people who have nothing but debt. And it's the people in between who get screwed. And I personally would do everything I could not to be one of those people in between. Am I making sense, Dan?
Yeah, well, I've got my home paid for, so much debt free. But
you're in the catbird seat.
I worry more about my children, you know.
Yeah.
Let's
hope that, you know, crashes. A crash can be, unfortunately, a crash can be a catalyst for change. And in 2008, we had a crash, and it produced a change. That is, you know, it brought into power a politician, Barack Obama, and Democratic control of both the House and Senate on a progressive platform. Unfortunately, that progressive platform in large part did not get delivered, although pieces of it certainly did. And, you know, the change that we really needed, the really large substantive change, didn't happen. But, Dan, thank you for the call. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past due. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. And Matthew Schmidt is with us. He is the director of Total Freedom and the website basicincomeforall.com. Matthew, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Hi. Oh, and Lila's with you, too. Hey,
hi.
Lila.
I'm surprised.
Lila Connors, the people who basically brought you these the three DiCaprio videos that we've done and the 11th Hour and a bunch of other great stuff. So, Matthew and Lila, you guys are working on a new project, this basicincomeforall.com website and this new movie about Basic Income for All. Tell us about it.
Well, Matthew has been taking the lead on our end on this project. From my point of view, I was astonished to find out that for several hundred years, there's been a conversation around giving people a basic income, which is a check every month that supports basic needs in order to liberate people's participation in the economy and allowing them to get away from the worry of basic survival. And people have been talking about it as a basic right, a human right, that if you cannot basically feed and house yourself, then therefore your rights are not being met. And given the state of our economies and the wealth that exists in our economies, we actually can pay for this, and therefore...
Whoop. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Poverty, inequality, and things like that. So for me, when Matthew brought this to Tree Media, I jumped on it and I said, this is absolutely the next project we need to do, because it seems from all across the political spectrum, right to left, a very intriguing idea that may actually solve a lot of our problems that we're seeing today.
So the essence of this, Matthew, is that everybody in America gets somewhere between $20,000 and $35,000 a year, basically just for being a citizen?
Yeah, it would have to be determined how much, but the key factor is that it needs to meet the basic needs. So anything under that really doesn't make sense, because it still keeps people in the need to cover their existence, and that should be taken care of by the basic income.
Right.
So it can be determined what that is in the United States. In Switzerland, they pegged it at $2,800 for an adult
per month.
Per month.
Right. So that's a little over $30,000 a year in Switzerland they're looking at. Now, the inevitable objection to this, particularly from conservatives, but I think probably for many people, is going to be, wait a minute, if people have, you know, $30,000 a year, which is enough to live on, for not working, who's going to go to work?
Well, that's an interesting thing that we believe it's an asset. I think this brings up a discussion about what the human being is and what we do as humans. And work is actually something that people do regardless of pay, in the sense that we need to split apart income and work. Work is biography. And therefore, if we have our basic needs met, the creativity may be unleashed. I mean, how many people out there are doing something that they don't really want to do, but if they had their basic needs met, they might take a risk in creating something that may yet be, you know, an invention or pursuing their life's work that they haven't yet been able to find because they had to cover their basic needs.
So you're saying this would provide a basis for an explosion of creativity in our society?
Precisely.
Yes, I think that's just explosive creativity. I think the creativity will actually make it to the marketplace, make it into the shops, make it into the service industry, and the boom is unforeseen. I mean, if somebody is a carpenter and has an idea for a small device that he thinks would be great for children to have, and you know, and he or she is going to be encouraged
to try that out
and bring it to the market.
Yeah.
And I can become then another
source of income. For
exactly.
Them. And the other thing is it's basic income. And so humans, as we see, like to accumulate wealth often. And so this is not just, you know, you can still work. So you can still add to that income. This
right.
is just basically taking care of basic needs. And again, some of the entitlement programs that may not be working as well may go away because of that. So we might be saving money on entitlements. We're not saying in our film that's what we're exploring. We're not getting rid of all entitlements, but we can relook at what is necessary at this point in terms of creating social safety nets and maybe reallocate the money in a more dignified way to people rather than put them through many hoops that I know exist right now.
Yeah, we're talking with Lila Connors and Matthew Schmidt, the producer and director of Total Freedom. You can find out all about it at their website, basicincomeforall.com. And, working to produce a major motion picture, a major documentary, rather, on, I guess would be the correct way to say it, on this topic, which I think is just such a noble thing. And another question for you all. People are going to say, but people won't work. And I think you've got the answer to that. People are also going to say, but who's going to pay for it?
Well, there's many ways to pay for it. Some places, like you've mentioned before, Alaska has a resource fund. We could do things like tax carbon and move some of that to households. We can look at consumption taxes. We can look at putting a small wealth tax in. There are many ways to address it. I think that most people that talk about this know that the wealth is in the system. It's just it'll be a very lively discussion how to pay for it. We know we can pay for it. And, Tom, I want to mention one other thing. Environmentally, this is also a huge benefit to the environment because people who are dealing with issues of poverty can't prioritize the environment. And once these basic needs are met, we can advance social agendas. Things like the environment can become more central to what we need to take care of. So in terms of creating a long-term sustainable society that addresses inequality, poverty, environmental issues, basic income may be our only hope to do that.
Wow. That's an extraordinary statement, but I think that there's a lot of truth to it. I mean, we're doing a basic income of sorts in the United States right now. You've got the child tax credit. You've got the earned income credit. You've got, food stamps. And I mean, all these things add up to a basic income of a couple $1,000s a year. But let's make it real. Matthew Schmidt, Lila Connors, we're out of time. But thank you so much for being with us. The website is basicincomeforall.com. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Tom.
Keep up the great work. It really and truly is great work that you're doing. Basic Income for All. Check it out. We'll be back. It's 28 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
BasicIncomeForAll.com. Well, this is interesting. WUSA Channel 9. Next Generation of News, a Gannett company. Okay, so this is the people who own USA Today. Byline Washington. It's small, it's bright yellow, and it's capable of cracking Wi-Fi passwords, eavesdropping on your cell phone calls, and reading your text message. It's an unmanned spy drone, and it just landed in Washington, D.C. Oops. Anyhow, Sherrod Brown had to go attend to Senate business, so it's just you and me. Anything goes Friday here. Linda in Deerfield Beach, Florida. Hey, Linda, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Linda.
You answered one of my questions was those who have everything paid off, you're going to be fine. Those that are in extreme debt,
your situation isn't going to get any worse.
Right. But my question is, say you have a little nest egg of maybe 30, 40,000.
Right.
And you also have a credit union and you have a regular bank.
Mm-hmm.
Can they come in if it crashes again and just say, we need your money?
It's interesting. There's a debate going on. There's a bill that came out of Europe that, according to Ellen Brown. Okay, Ellen Brown writes about this over at webofdebt.com. You can read her most recent op-ed on this. That would suggest that And there's an effort to make this happen here in the United States, that are you familiar with the bail-in thing that happened in Cyprus? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, yes, I do.
Okay, so for people who don't know what we're talking about, let me just recap it really, really quickly. When the Cyprus banks went down, Cyprus's banking rules were such that the bank, if the bank was $1 million in debt, rather than having the bank close their doors, they would simply steal $1 million from the depositors. And they did this because the deposits were considered assets of the banks. And here in the United States, deposits are considered liabilities for the banks. They're money that has to be returned to the depositors if they ever ask for it. They're demand liabilities. And so if you shift the way that the deposits are booked from liabilities to assets, then the bank can simply use those as assets, or they can borrow against them as assets. Right now, whether our banks can do that is in question. The FDIC is underfunded. There are a lot of structural problems with our banking system. And if I was banking with one of the six big banks in the United States, I'd be a little nervous, other than just doing small routine banking, you know, keeping a minimum balance in there. Credit unions are great. Credit unions are protected by a different set of rules than banks are. They haven't been corrupted, although there's a real effort on the part of these big banks to take away their nonprofit status. Credit unions are co-ops. They're owned by their members. The number of shares you own in the credit union is the number of dollars you have on deposit with them. You can run for their officers. You can run for their board of directors. You can have a say in how they're run. And, you know, I think credit unions, and in fact, you know, Arianna Huffington started this thing, and I was promoting it also back in 2008 about divestment, basically, having everybody in America move your money out of banks, or at least big banks, into either local banks or credit unions, or S&Ls, for that matter. S&Ls also are somewhat insulated from banks, although they tend to be for-profit organizations, as are community banks, whereas I think that the best deal out there is credit unions. Did I answer your question, Linda?
Perfectly. Thank
okay.
you so much.
Thanks, thanks a lot for the call. Chris in Chicago. Hey, Chris, what's up? Chris in Chicago? No. Yeah, you're on the air, Chris.
Sorry, I had to pull the phone off of the speaker system.
Okay.
I talked to you a couple weeks ago, and I proposed kind of a Grover Norquist litmus test for Democratic candidates, and it was the day your phone system fried out. It actually fried out during my call.
Ah.
I wasn't able to.
Okay.
The infamous day. So
yeah.
I wasn't able to really follow up on it. And you made it into a pledge to repeal Reaganism, and I disagreed with that because somebody please tell me where Reaganism ended and Clintonism began.
Oh, it didn't. In fact, this is the thing that I'm astonished was not in the front page of the New York Times. Chuck Schumer, a week ago Monday, right here in Washington, D.C., gave a speech in which he said that Bill Clinton governed in the mold of Ronald Reagan rather than in the mold of Franklin Roosevelt, that the rules of Reaganomics, which were established in 1981, the fundamental change of America, of America's economic and political system, has not been reversed yet.
Right, I agree. And you know, most presidential historians have concluded that the Clinton years were a continuation of the so-called Reagan Revolution,
yeah,
not a reaction against it.
I agree. So, although I would say that the election of Clinton in 92 was a reaction against it, because if you go back, I wrote this in my book Threshold. There's a whole chapter about it, and where I've got the New Covenant speech that Bill Clinton used as his stump speech all over the country. That's what he ran on. And what he ran on was strengthening Social Security, developing a national health care system, restoring workers' rights, rolling back Taft-Hartley, or at least the local variations on it, supporting the right to unionize. These are the things that he ran on explicitly. They're not the things he governed on.
Yeah, and he passed the 1994 Interstate Banking Act over the objections of a lot of Democrats and with the help of the Republicans.
Right.
Remember, the Democrats controlled Congress still.
Yeah, there's an interesting op-ed, Chris, apropos of this, in today's Huffington Post that talks about triangulation, and which is what Clinton did. He would when the Republicans were in charge, he would take a few conservative Democrats and a couple of Republicans, and he basically split the Republican Party down the middle. He would force them into a fight with each other, and then one side would end up on his side, and along with some Democrats, he could pass legislation and get things done. And that was a left-right battle. And what this article in the Huffington Post points out is that in the case of this bill, that basically Obama just used triangulation to pass. He just used the Clinton strategy. This bill is not a left-right bill. It's an inside-outside bill. the insiders in Washington, D.C. want to get the bill passed. They want government to keep on going. They want to get all this stuff done. And they want to suck up to their big donors. The outsiders, that's you, Chris, me, you know, everybody else in America, we're looking at this going, we're horrified. The, you know, left, right, in between. I mean, you look at Drudge, and there, and he's talking about at the very top of Drudge, he's talking about Obama Boehner. I mean, he runs it all together into one word, Obama Boehner, or Boehner Obama, whatever it is. Legislation, you know, is full of pork and this, that, and the other thing. So, you know, I don't think triangulation is going to work. I think that this president's probably going to try it a lot in the next 2 years. I fear it may blow up in his face. Pardon my going off on a digression there.
My Democratic congressman was one of the evil 57. So I think the bumper sticker slogan should be reinstate Glass-Steagall. It's a 37-page bill. It was in place for 67 years. It worked. And I don't think that's over the head of the average American.
I would, respectfully, Chris, I would submit to you that probably if you were to stand on the streets in Chicago and ask people as they walk by, what did Glass-Steagall regulate? That one out of maybe 60 people could tell you, would say banks.
But I don't think I don't think it's a steep educational curve.
No, I don't think it is either. But I think if you had, I'm still fond of repeal Reaganomics, or repeal trickle down economics.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you for taking my call. I want to say one other thing. I'm sorry, Sherrod Brown didn't make it. My fellow Ohio State alumnus, and I beg him to run for president. He will have my vote, my money, and my time. And one other thing, don't give Rahm Emanuel too much credit for this minimum wage in Chicago. He was silent on it until this summer, and he only supported it because he is in the fight for his political life.
Yeah, but on the one hand. On the other hand, when politicians do the thing that they're supposed to do because there's clear public pressure, that's how the system's supposed to work. So, you know, point noted, Chris, and it's an important point. But at least he's on the right side of it right now. Chris, thank you for the call. You're Richard in Evanston, Illinois. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Oh, hi. Maybe it should be Random Friday for my call here. But, you know, I was just going to say when the crash, if a crash does happen, it's going to hurt everybody. I mean, I lost my job because of it, basically. So
I'm not saying it's going to be painless. I'm horrified by what's already happening.
And also my ex has a pension, and, you know, now the pension funds aren't getting the money that they would get normally. And so now they're going to cut back pensions. So, I mean, it really destroyed everybody, which is what is so remarkable that they voted the Republicans back in. But what I really called about was your take on why lower oil prices, which are raw materials for the entire economy, now all you hear on the news is that this is driving the stock market down. And I just said, what kind of an economy, what kind of a market, and what kind of economy do we have if a raw material could drop this much in price, and this is bad news?
Right. That's a really good point, Richard. We have a financialized economy. If you look at the stock market, if you look at all the so-called wealth in the stock market, and it's exploded to levels and in ways that we haven't seen since 1929, a lot of it is not manufacturing. In fact, I would argue probably the majority of it is not manufacturing. Manufacturing being driven by energy, by oil and other fossil fuels. Instead, it's financial services, banksterism. Would you like fries with that? Retail. And those are things that are not oil intensive. We've moved all our manufacturing to China, or not all of it, but the large percentage of it. So now when the price of oil goes down, what it does is it destabilizes a lot of economy or a lot of industries in this country that have to do with oil, because we're now the leading oil producer in the world, or number two, depending on which day you're looking at it. And so there's this major disequilibrium happening right now in the energy industry in the United States. And the price of oil falling is also going to hurt really badly the solar industry, which has created almost 100,000 jobs just in the last couple of years in the United States. The solar industry, the wind industry, they're all going to be hurt by the price of oil falling. I'm not in favor of the price of oil going up. I'm not in favor of it going down. I'm not taking either of those positions. I'm just pointing out that there's a whole bunch of variables here. It's a very different economy than it was before the Reagan years. Richard, thank you for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's a very different world even than when Jimmy Carter was president, you know, before Reagan, where when the oil prices went up, the economy went down. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. Randy watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Ottawa, Iowa. Hey, Randy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I am so torn about the comment, but I have to I think that this change to the Dodd-Frank will make the investor vulnerable, the retirees and stuff like that.
I agree, because they're going to sell these derivatives to pension funds and retirement funds.
My original comment was about this climate summit down in Brazil.
In Peru, yeah.
Peru, excuse me. And I watched that yesterday afternoon on Democracy Now, and, you know, it was kind of it's kind of disturbing, because when you look at how plundering has of resources has worked in South America, those are some of the countries down there, and it was mostly Indians and brown people that were there protesting. I mean, there are very few whites. And what I saw there was that, or what it came was, a lot of people were disappearing, even back in the 90s, who were trying to protect their country's resources and the ecology of their country, their commons. And it's not the corporations that are disappearing these people, it's the government that's been disappearing them. And I look at the state of affairs in our country right now, how corporate influence has reached in so far and has changed the balance of justice in this country, and it is really disturbing. It's like a view into our future, almost, it seems. That was pretty much my the comment, and I wanted to, there's a similar thing happening in the United States today, and that's in the defense bill, John McCain is trying to, as I understand it, give away Indian land, Apache land, to an Australian mining company to start a new copper mine.
That's correct. Rio Tinto. Yeah.
Yeah. So thank you so much for taking my call. What a great show today.
Thank
God bless you.
Thank you. And you too. Thank you very much. Yeah, Rio Tinto is going to get Apache Tears, which is a part of New Mexico, or part of Arizona, where it's sort of the Masada for the Apaches. If you're familiar with the story of Masada, it's a mountaintop or a butte top sort of thing in the southern part of Israel. I've been there a couple of times, actually. And it's where back, you know, thousands of years ago or hundreds of years, I don't know when, but a bunch of Israelis were being attacked by a bunch of other people who wanted to kill them all. And they just basically stayed up there, kept off the attackers until there was no other thing to do, and then they all committed suicide. And the Apaches did the same thing. Only the Apaches jumped to their death. In Masada, I think they killed each other, but as I recall, I could be wrong. But and that's called Apache Tears, and it's a holy site for Apaches, not just because of that incident. I mean, it's got a long, long history. And John McCain put this into the Defense Appropriation Bill, as far as I know, to turn this publicly owned property, this federal property, which really should be the property of the Apache, to turn this over to Rio Tinto, to an Australian mining company, and let them turn it into a giant copper mine, which is a god-awful thing, by the way. The largest copper mine in the United States you can see from outer space. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to everyone at the various companies that syndicate our program, Westwood One, Pacifica, SiriusXM, Cable Radio Network, Free Speech TV on Dish Network and DirecTV, all the cable companies that carry our show, Manhattan Neighborhood Networks and others, all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on the big picture, to the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn, to Netroots Radio, to our newsletter editor Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room, hello, to Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, Bob Ney, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, radio and TV, to our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you so much. Bob in Clifton, Tennessee. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind today?
Well, hello, Tom. Well, I would like to give you a homework assignment, and next week I would like you to come in with a cartoon that you have drawn, and I'm going to explain it to you now.
Okay, I will hopelessly disappoint you, Bob, because I can't draw worth a hoot, but
you
go for the cartoon.
One easily.
Maybe there's a cartoonist in the audience.
Near the top of the page, draw a picture of a kite, simple kite, and label it the economy.
Right.
From the kite, in order to provide stability, you need a tail on the kite. Label that ethics.
How about labeling that regulation?
No. The string that allows the kite to fly is the regulation.
Okay.
And at the bottom, you have the population holding the string. And the economy flies as long as it has adequate regulation, but not over-regulation. It can't be a rope or the kite won't fly. It needs to be reasonable regulation for a string for the kite to fly. And if you want to add an arm with a pair of scissors coming in to cut the string, that could be labeled, oh, I don't know, GOP, deregulation.
Right.
And you will have an easily transmittable image for people to understand the economy. The economy flies when it has the stability of ethics and the string of regulation. And if you cut that string, the kite will not fly. And if you take away the ethics, the kite will spiral out of control.
Yeah. Excellent point. The one thing I would add to it is that in an economy that is larger than a local community, you can't rely on ethics alone. You have to codify ethics into law because there are people called sociopaths who have no ethical center. And if something's legal, even if it's immoral, they will do it. And so, you know, it might be unethical, for example, to gamble, in derivatives with FDIC-insured deposits. But if it's not illegal, you can bet that the psychopaths on Wall Street will do it. So the ethics really need to be institutionalized as law.
And I would give you a bumper sticker. And at first it may conflict with your reformist attitude, but I would say this. Capitalism rewards sociopaths.
Oh, it's true. It's absolutely true. And the more unregulated the capitalism is, the more power sociopaths have in it, which is one of the reasons why you've got some very, very rich and very powerful sociopaths who are pushing really, really hard to deregulate capitalism even farther. Excellent point, Bob, and a great cartoon. And I'm guessing pretty much everybody could have organized that in their brain as you were saying it. I think you just shared it with everybody. Thank you. Thomas in Bennington, Vermont. Hey, Thomas, what's up?
Hello, Tom.
Hey, Thomas.
I'd like to talk about I'm a retired police officer from Suffolk County. I went on in 1966, and when you take the test, you get a couple extra points if you're a veteran, and I was a veteran.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, the poor veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan with PTSD go on police departments still suffering from that.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I've never heard somebody mention that before. And, I'm thinking of, raise your hands, don't shoot, you know, surrender.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it's really just sad. And if that little boy in Cleveland was 6'3", the police wouldn't have drove right up to him. They would have stopped a block away, you know.
Yeah, maybe. Apparently we had an officer here who was really a wreck. He fell apart on a firing range in his previous job, and the firing range instructor had to take him to a local restaurant and hold him because he was sobbing. I mean, that's how bad this guy was. He had some kind of flashback or something. The reason I think that you don't hear much conversation, Thomas, about veterans with PTSD moving into the job market, where they have weapons, jobs like police, is that a lot of veterans are coming back without PTSD. And if we had a lot of discussion about that, it might make people a little sketchy about hiring veterans. And that's not a good thing for our veterans.
I understand that. I understand that.
Yeah. So we have to figure out a way to deal with the PTSD and treat it, or clearly label people with PTSD as disabled so that they qualify for enough disability that they don't have to work a job, that they don't have to, you know, go out and get a job as a security guard someplace or a police officer someplace where they're carrying a gun. And because, like you said, there's a potential problem there. But on the other hand, you know, we've got to figure out, and maybe, you know, you said you took a test in 1966. I think we need our tests should be able to filter out PTSD. What do you think?
I would hope so.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. Thomas, thank you for the call. And thanks so much for watching us there in Bennington. Wow, it's been an incredible week. And this is just the beginning. The next 2 years are going to be absolutely fascinating. And I think that they're going to be pivotal in the state and future of this nation and the world. So please participate. Right? These are the times that try men's souls, to paraphrase Thomas Paine. And we need to stand up. We need to not be the summer soldiers and the sunshine patriots, but rather the winter soldiers. We need to show up. Tag, you're in. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next month.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.